Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
One of the most powerful members of the Florida legislature may be on his way out in the wake of sexual harassment allegations.
And honestly, it looks at this point that they're heading towards expulsion. And if he's expelled, he'll be one of the first sitting members in the legislature expelled in who knows how long, decades.
Also this week, first responders who develop PTSD on the job can't get compensation unless they have a physical injury too. But Florida lawmakers are trying to change that.
It's our duty to address this growing crisis and to support the men and women who never fail to support us and our communities.
We'll also get the latest on a move to place a memorial to the enslaved on the grounds of the Florida Capitol and find out how a political shootout between competing pro-gun groups could mean no gun legislation at all this legislative session. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. All of the recent focus on sexual harassment and deplorable behavior by powerful men hasn't been confined to the national stage. The issue is also causing chaos in the Florida legislature. Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala continues to fight against allegations of sexual harassment, but there's mounting evidence he's on the losing end. Lynn Hatter reports the state's House Speaker said recently Latvala could end up being kicked out of the chamber in January.
January is when the Senate probe into Latvala's behavior and the accusations of sexual harassment by six women is set to resume, and that's the earliest the chamber could take a vote on how and whether to punish Latvala. It would take two-thirds of senators voting in favor of expulsion in order for Latvala to be removed. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Lauren Book of Plantation filed a complaint accusing Latvala of trying to intimidate his accusers, including Senate aide Rachel Perrin Rogers, who was the first accuser to be publicly named. Speaking to C-SPAN's Washington Journal, House Speaker Richard Corcoran says he thinks Latvala's expulsion is likely.
And honestly, it looks at this point that they're heading towards expulsion, and then they'll have the full floor vote should it get to that level and have the vote on expulsion. If he's expelled, he'll be one of the first sitting members in the legislature expelled in who knows how long, decades.
Recent campaign reports show Latvala, who's running for governor, raising very little money. Corcoran has called for the senator's resignation, and others have followed suit, namely the Florida Democratic Party and its gubernatorial candidates Andrew Gillum and Gwen Graham, along with Governor Rick Scott.
If the allegations are true, he needs to resign.
Scott spoke with NPR member station WLRN. Latvala found himself surrounded by scandal on the heels of the resignation of Democratic Senator Jeff Clemons. Clemons stepped down after Politico Florida reported he had an affair with a lobbyist. Last month, Latvala spoke extensively about ethics and personal behavior during the Associated Press's annual planning day, but he dodged a question about banning relationships between lawmakers and lobbyists.
My experience has been through the years that a lot of times the people that talk the loudest about ethics and conflicts of interest and whatever are the people who have the most of them. And I've never made a practice to try to get involved and criticize my opponents or my colleagues. I figure they got to look in the mirror every day when they get up. And they got to account for themselves, and I got to account for myself.
Shortly after Politico Florida published accounts from then-anonymous women alleging Latvala had sexually harassed them. The fighting between Latvala and his accusers has gone on now for more than a month, with both a Senate rules investigation and one being conducted by an outside counsel pending. Florida lawmakers are set to return to Tallahassee in January to start their 2018 lawmaking session, with Latvala in the middle of a political storm that shows no sign of dissipating anytime soon. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
It's not just lascivious behavior that's bedeviling Florida politicians. After being found guilty this year on charges related to the improper use of campaign funds, former state representative Dwayne Taylor was sentenced today to 13 months in federal prison. That's a story out of the Daytona Beach News Journal. Taylor, a Democrat from Daytona Beach, was convicted August 31st on 9 counts of wire fraud. U.S. District Judge Carlos Mendoza, who issued the sentence, refused in September to acquit or order a new trial for Taylor. Mendoza wrote that prosecutors used ATM video recordings of Taylor moving money from a campaign bank account to a personal account. It's illegal in Florida to use campaign contributions for normal living expenses. Taylor, who is aged 50, served in the Florida House from 2008 to 2016. First responders run toward crashes, emergencies, and catastrophes, not away from them. And for some, their experiences are leading to post-traumatic stress disorder. But in Florida, first responders who develop PTSD on the job don't get compensated unless they have a physical injury as well. Kate Payne reports on efforts to change that. A note to listeners, this story includes frank talk of death and suicide.
For many first responders, post-traumatic stress disorder is becoming part of the job. The condition follows exposure to death, injuries, or violence. Those affected may have flashbacks and nightmares, or they can become aggressive or destructive. Michael Glukowski from Spring Hill is a retired New York State trooper.
7 years I was in a nightmare. PTSD is a parasite in the brain. If it's not taken care of, control, it grows and eats your brain.
For some first responders, PTSD is deadly.
The research is out there. Firefighters are 3 times more likely to die by suicide than they are to die in the line of duty.
Megan Vila's brother, Stevie Ledoux, was a firefighter paramedic for the city of Tampa. He developed PTSD after 29 years of service, responding to countless traumatic incidents. He ultimately wasn't fit to work.
He, along with his captain, Lawson Carter, filed a workers' compensation claim on his behalf. And they pulled him out of work, and he was seeing the city psychiatrist for 2 months.
The city denied Ledoux's workers' comp claim because he didn't have a physical injury as well, a requirement under current Florida law.
My brother was forced to pay back the 2 months of work that he missed, and this put him into a deeper depression. And my brother brought this to me on my back patio before he took his life. Sorry. And I am making it my mission to change this law.
Now Vila is working to ensure first responders get the medical treatment and paid leave her brother was denied. Plantation Democrat Lauren Book is sponsoring a bill in the Senate that would allow compensation for PTSD on its own.
It's our duty to address this growing crisis and to support the men and women who never fail to support us and our communities.
The measure would only apply to first responders who witness or arrive at the scene of certain incidents, like murders, suicides, and mass casualty events. And a licensed psychiatrist would have to diagnose the condition. Dozens of first responders and family members came to a recent Senate committee to show their support for the measure. Rocco Salvatore is with the Florida Professional Firefighters Association.
Because of the stigma associated with talking about some of these things, this may have been just as scary for some of these people as wrestling with a bad guy, reaching for their gun, or running into a fire, or driving their ambulance towards machine gun fire.
The Florida League of Cities spoke against the measure, citing concerns about potential fraud and costs for local government. It's not yet clear what the change could cost governments or insurers. But Megan Vila says under a similar law in Minnesota, the impacts have been minimal.
And then the claims that were diagnosed and got treatment from 2013 until now, they've spent $1.2 million. $1.2 million. I mean, really, that's nominal with what we spend as a state and what we can potentially give our first responders.
The committee ultimately passed the bill. It is 3 more stops to go before the floor. The move comes at a time when a first responder to the Pulse nightclub shooting was fired after developing PTSD. Omar Delgado says he was wrongfully dismissed because of his condition, and he'll lose out on retirement benefits because of it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Still to come on Capitol Report, 3 million Floridians could be breaking the law.
We need to make sure that the individuals that are playing fantasy sports are not subject to some criminal penalties.
We'll get the latest on a slew of gun proposals that appear dead for the 2018 legislative session.
The real compromise we're looking for is between two very different schools of thought. I don't know that these two sides are ever going to come together in reconciliation to agreement.
And a Florida slavery memorial is moving forward, but not without some quibbling.
And I would like to honor people rather than being about the institution.
About 3 million Floridians play fantasy sports, and one state senator wants to be sure they won't be charged with a crime. Regan McCarthy has more.
Fantasy sports are games of skill, and therefore not gambling. That's according to Tampa Republican Senator Dana Young, who's sponsoring a bill to clarify that point.
We need to make sure that the individuals that are playing fantasy sports are not subject to some criminal penalties because of any uncertainty in our statute. There are several requirements that need to be met for these contests to take place, and this bill simply puts those requirements into statute and clarifies that it is not gambling because these contests are games of skill.
The measure is receiving pushback from anti-gambling groups like No Casinos. Paul Sego works for the organization. He says allowing fantasy sports violates the state constitution.
It is our argument that those games are played as a pari-mutuel pool. And the text of Article 10, Section 7 says lotteries accept those forms of pari-mutuel wagering approved at the time of the passage of the Constitution are hereby prohibited. And it is our reading that obviously these games were not in approval in 1968 when the Constitution was passed. And therefore, our reading is that it violates Article 10, Section 7.
Meanwhile, the Seminole Indian Tribe is warning the move could impact its gambling exclusivity agreement with the state. It sent a letter to the legislature raising concerns about Young's bill, along with several others. But Young says she doesn't foresee a problem. She says fantasy sports don't fall under the category of games regulated in the tribe's gambling compact.
Class 3 gaming are things like card games, blackjack, baccarat, things of that nature, table games like roulette and craps, slot machines, pari-mutuels, all sorts of your traditional gaming activities. I don't think anyone here believes that 10 guys sitting around a table in the office with fantasy sports teams constitutes any sort of traditional casino gaming. And so the bill would in no way implicate that provision of the contract relating to Class 3 gaming.
Furthermore, Young says these games don't count as gambling because they're games of skill. But
even if these were deemed internet or online gaming, there would be no compact implication in terms of revenue to the state of Florida because that section only deals with guaranteed minimum payments by the tribe to the state, and those guaranteed minimum payments have already been satisfied and have been paid in full. So even if, which I would dispute, this did qualify, there would be no revenue implication to the state.
Young's bill passed the Senate Regulated Industries Committee. It has one committee left to go. The bill's counterpart in the House has not yet received its first hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The official start to the 2018 legislative session is about a month away, and already some high-profile gun bills appear to be dead. As Sasha Cordner reports, discussions surrounding the proposals not only pit Republicans against one another, it's led to sparring between gun rights groups as well.
Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell's bill gives places of worship attached to a school the authority to allow guns on the private property.
There are two schools of thought. Some people believe that if we keep guns out of hands, bad things won't happen. And then I have the school of thought that believes that the best way to stop a bad person with a gun is a good person with a gun. I don't think we're going to solve that issue today and come to a reconciliation between those two schools of thought. I think everyone fully believes their position on those issues.
But during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, Roy Blondo, a former prosecutor, disagreed.
One thing I learned during my 35 years as a prosecuting attorney is that more guns mean more killing. Now, this lady argued that the answer to a bad man with a gun is a good person with a gun. Well, what is a good person with a gun? People who have concealed weapon permits are not experts in guns.
And in its very first committee, Stargell's measure failed on a 4-6 vote, with two South Florida Republicans joining Democrats in opposing the bill. Then it was Sarasota Republican Senator Greg Stubbe's turn with his so-called courthouse carry bill. That would have allowed guns inside a courthouse, but the guns would have to be stored with security officers. But Stubbe didn't stop there. He amended the bill to include other gun proposals. They included Stargell's failed proposal. Another lowered penalties for accidental displays of a firearm.
It also has language as it relates to bump stocks. Look at lines 262 to 268. We are urging the United States Congress and President Trump to instruct the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to revisit and review all previous rulings related to bump stocks and issue a clarifying ruling and a national policy that will apply uniformly to all of the states.
Bump stocks are modifications that increase a weapon's rate of fire. Meanwhile, Stubbe's bill also included a provision that created mixed feelings among gun rights groups.
Currently, if somebody goes and purchases a firearm, and the background check pops back from FDLE as a decline, nothing is done, FDLE just declines that, and the firearms dealer goes about their business and doesn't issue the firearm. So what this bill also has language to do is if FDLE, when they do the background check, it comes back as a decline, they are to notify local law enforcement, let local law enforcement come out and investigate why whoever it was that was trying to purchase the firearm was declined.
The National Rifle Association supported the new changes, but Eric Friday with gun rights group Florida Carry says while he supports the courthouse carry bill, he does not support some of the new changes, particularly provisions turning over rejected background checks to local law enforcement for investigation.
The amendment will result in prosecution and investigation and arrest of law-abiding citizens by mistake.
And as for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, the Gun Control Advocates Group opposed all the measures. Here's Jamie Ito from the group.
It would make it easier to carry hidden, loaded guns into buildings that house courtrooms, and it would also subject our local officials to lawsuits and penalties for trying to protect public safety. The bill has been amended to include two other dangerous policies. These include provisions to allow open carry in public places and to allow guns in private schools.
Senate Democrats on the Judiciary Committee also opposed the bills, and Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia says he voted against the proposals for several reasons.
The fact that we combine all these bills into one massive package, I just have a difficult time supporting it. You're talking to someone that believes that we should not do things to take away the right of individuals to own guns, and we should do more to ensure that people have access to mental health treatments and substance abuse treatment, and yet this bill does nothing to do to address those issues.
And with the failure of each proposal to pass, Florida Carry in its newsletter blamed Senator Garcia and Miami Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores for helping to tank several of the proposals. The NRA's Marion Hammer also did the same, adding Florida Carry to her target list. In her newsletter to her members, she stated Florida Carry sided with Moms Demand Action, not Florida gun owners. Meanwhile, Senator Greg Stubbe says he has no plans to bring any gun bills forward for the 2018 session. Still, at least one of his gun-related measures appears to be moving forward in the Florida Senate. It allows firearm dealers to pay for the criminal background checks of potential gun buyers. And at least one gun bill is also starting to move in Congress. The U.S. House of Representatives voted recently to make concealed carry permits valid across state lines. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
A new Florida law allows any state resident to challenge what's being taught in public schools. A handful of complaints have been filed in school districts statewide since the law took effect in July. Kathy Carter with member station WUSF in Tampa spoke with Renalia DuBose, a professor at WMU Cooley Law School in Tampa, about what the new Florida textbook challenge law is all about.
Professor, previously challenges could only be made by parents, and under this new law, any resident can challenge the use of textbooks and instructional materials in schools. So exactly how does the process work now?
Well, a parent or a resident would file a petition with the school district saying that they don't agree with material that's been adopted. And basically they can challenge if they feel like it's too pornographic, if it is demeaning to a certain ethnic group, or if it doesn't meet the next generation Sunshine State standards. So you would file that petition, and then the district would get a hearing officer, and you would have a hearing, and then the hearing officer would make a recommendation to the board, and the board's decision would be final.
Now, proponents of the law says it makes the process much easier, but you say it's actually unnecessary. Why?
First of all, if you don't like something that the board has done, you have the opportunity in the open forum section of any board meeting to go and talk to the board. So basically, now you've got a procedure that is another layer of bureaucracy. The statute doesn't say how the procedure should roll out. The statute doesn't say the qualifications of the hearing officer, other than the person cannot be an employee of the district. It doesn't say the procedure for the hearing, and I think it's just going to open the door to lots of legal challenges, mainly due to the lack of specificity. And of course, the resident, if the hearing officer doesn't agree with them, they're going to claim bias. When people have the right to speak directly to their boards, I think that needs to be the avenue to make your feelings heard, because the way the legislation is written, the hearing officer is now going to become your voice.
Now, critics have argued that this law could lead to book banning, and some, including the ACLU, have suggested that outside groups could come in and influence the process. How would that happen?
Well, it seems like a simple process to establish residency, but let me tell you, that is a very complicated process, and now they've put the district in the position of determining residency for people that want to make a challenge. And my concern is district staff is short, it is lean, districts are short of funds, and now we've got to put a whole new process in place and pay the hearing officer and use staff time.
But again, some would say, that's what I'm paying taxes for. I'm a member of the community. I should be heard.
Well, I will tell you, dating back to the time when Horace Mann established public education systems, everybody has never agreed with everything that's being taught. Some people don't like evolution. Some people don't like creation. Some people didn't want their children hearing about Buddhism. Some people don't want their children hearing about World War II and what happened with Germany and Italy. You will never get 100% agreement. If we held school up until everybody agreed, we would never be able to educate children. And the state has said what curriculum needs to be based on the next generation Sunshine State standards. Florida Statute 1006.31 and Florida Statute 1006.40 outlines the basic requirements for curriculum and textbook materials. But if we're expecting that everybody's going to be happy, that will never happen.
That's WMU Cooley Law School professor Renalia DuBose speaking with WUSF's Kathy Carter. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, when the 2018 lawmaking session begins in January, Florida lawmakers will again wrestle with who we honor and how we memorialize them. Nick Evans reports one measure would establish a monument, another would remove one.
This month, a measure establishing a slavery memorial at the Florida Capitol began moving in the state Senate. Here's St. Petersburg Democrat Daryl Roussan.
This Senate bill provides legislative intent, first to recognize the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the American colonies, including Florida.
The same bill has already made it to the House floor. House Minority Leader Keone McGee has navigated his measure through three committees without a single no vote. The only pushback he's gotten has been minimal, from Jacksonville Republican Jay Fant.
And no thought process on, despite how much it is, how we will pay for it, through which budget process or foundation or outside of, is it taxpayer expense or is it going to be private expense?
McGee says how much and where from are questions for a later day, but he says public and private dollars will fund the monument. And Fant voted in favor of the bill. As Senator Roussan introduced his bill, it seemed as though the Senate version would move along as quietly as the House bill.
This bill passed every committee in the House last session, passed off the House floor, and we have an opportunity to come back and thank you for your kindness, Mr. Chair, in agending this bill and allowing it to be heard.
But after the votes came in and the bill passed unanimously, one member decided to speak up.
Vice Chair Mayfield? Chair Baxley.
Yes. By your vote, Senate Bill 286 is reported favorably. I would like to comment since this bill has had some prominence.
This is Committee Chair Dennis Baxley, an Ocala Republican and the senator who refused to hear a similar bill earlier this year, effectively killing the legislation. As he did then, Baxley explains his opposition as a desire to honor people and not an institution. It's an excuse McGee panned last session, and Baxley says he now believes the bill addresses his concerns.
My only other comment would be that I do this with an expectation of permanency, that you should reasonably expect this will be a permanent placement, and I hope that we can keep growing a mutual respect for all of us honoring with permanency those who came before us.
But Baxley's support for the slavery memorial echoes his complaints against another bill wrapped up in Florida's antebellum legacy, replacing a statue of Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith with pioneering African-American educator Mary McLeod Bethune.
I expect that you're placing her in Statuary Hall with an anticipation of permanency. That's what we do. And so, regrettably, I can't vote for this because I think it's supporting the continuation of cultural purging and dishonoring of those who came before us.
Every state has two statues in the Washington, D.C. collection of illustrious men or women from their state. In addition to Smith, Florida is currently represented by John Gorey, an early developer of air conditioning. Despite Baxley's opposition, the measure to replace Smith's statue, like the one to establish a slavery memorial, appears to be in good position ahead of the official start of the lawmaking session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.